Welcome to the Veterans for Peace Radio Hour and podcast on Radio Free Nashville, 107.1 and 103.7, streaming live at radiofreenashville.org. Okay, Harvey and I are both on assignment, so we are going back to two important shows and share half. We have Ellen Davidson and her show on apartheid, and then the show with Dr. Walter Hickson and his show warning us about the dangers of AIPAC and the Israel lobby to our republic. But first, my name is Jim Wohlgemuth, and I'm here with fellow Vietnam veteran Harvey Bennett. We're members of Veterans for Peace. Veterans for Peace is an international organization of military veterans and allies whose collective efforts are to build a culture of peace, humanity, equality, and justice. Just go to veteransforpeace.org. This radio show and podcast is on stations across the country, thanks to the Pacifica Radio Network. We're also on SoundCloud, Anchor Podcast, Spotify, and your phone podcast app. Just search Veterans for Peace. The Veterans for Peace Radio Hour and Radio Free Nashville are supported in part by you, the listener, because it is you that keeps Radio Free Nashville going. And as a result, this radio show is picked up by the Pacifica Radio Network, so we're heard across the country. So if you think that is important, just go to Radio Free Nashville and click on the donate button and keep Harvey and I on the air in every time zone in the U.S. And if you support the work of Veterans for Peace, go to our site, veteransforpeace.org. Click the donate button there. Today, Ellen Davidson is going to join us. Ellen is a longtime activist and photojournalist. She works with Veterans for Peace and is a contributing editor for the Independent newspaper and managing editor of Peace and Planet News, which if you're not getting it, you need to get it. And you can find it by going to peaceandplanetnews.org and subscribe. Okay, with that, Ellen has traveled multiple times to the occupied West Bank, twice leading delegations of Veterans for Peace, and she was elected to serve on the Veterans for Peace National Board for 3 years beginning in 2024. So, Ellen, we read your article in Peace and Planet News about apartheid, and I was recently talking to an old friend from college who argued with me that Israel is not an apartheid state. So I want to talk about apartheid, and I want to just clear this up for all our listeners about apartheid. And I'd like you to share what you wrote in your article and about the experience of South Africa, and then bring up Israel and make the comparison. So
Well, thank you for having me, and thank you for this opportunity to talk about this subject, because I think it's very important. So apartheid, the word, literally means apartness. And it began as an ideology in South Africa, coincidentally in 1948, when Israel was founded. And the theory that the face that they put on it is that the races should have separate but equal development. And so this was a settler colonial regime in South Africa. And so as we know from segregation in schools in the United States, separate but equal is neither. Mm-hmm. So there were a number of laws that underlay this philosophy that kept things in place. Number one was that the Black native population of South Africa was considered to be citizens of what they called homelands or Bantustans. And these were these tiny little enclaves of not very usable land that were far from the urban centers and far from the areas of economic development. And many people were displaced to these lands and told, this is what you're a citizen of. You can't be in these other parts because you're not a citizen of these other parts of South Africa. So if you looked at a map of apartheid South Africa, you'd see these tiny little enclaves all over of these Bantustans. So the first pillar was displacement and land grabbing. And the second pillar was control of movement. And so for Black South Africans to move around in the white areas, which they had to, because that was where the only jobs were, they had to have certain permits, and they were only allowed to be in this place or that place. And so these were the famous pass laws in South Africa. And if you were stopped and didn't have your pass, or you presented it, but it wasn't specific for the exact place where you were, you could get arrested and taken to their jails, where you would no doubt be tortured. They were not pleasant places. So that's the third pillar, was just this massive militarized repression of the Black population. if you look at those three pillars, and a fourth pillar, small, somewhat less important, was language, the imposing the Afrikaans language as the official language of South Africa, and English, which is what people spoke if they spoke a Western language in the black areas, was not considered the first language. And so their schooling, there were student protests saying, you know, we want to be schooled in English, not in Afrikaans. Afrikaans is not our language. So those three pillars, though, displacement, control of movement, and severe repression. If you look at Israel, it's just a textbook case. If you look at a current map of Israel and the occupied territories, you'll see that the occupied territories are broken up into these tiny little enclaves that are separated by Israeli-controlled territory, by settlements, by roads that only Israeli citizens can drive on. So Palestinians cannot move even freely about in these areas. They're just all these tiny little separate dots. It's not, and would never be a viable country. And people who talk about a two-state solution have obviously never looked at this map, because there's no state there. There's a bunch of little Bantustans. And the control of movement in these areas, Israel has military checkpoints all through these areas. So for movement, just if you want to go from one Palestinian village to another, you frequently will have to go through an Israeli checkpoint in order to do that. And they have this physical wall that they've built. They call it the separation barrier. The Palestinians call it the apartheid wall. And in the urban areas, it's huge, 30-foot high concrete barrier. And there are places where it goes between a Palestinian village and their agricultural lands. There's a place that I've seen where it goes right through the middle of a playground next to a school. It goes right through the middle of Al-Quds University in Jerusalem. So for Palestinians to try and move around and live in these areas, it's very difficult. In Bethlehem, which is basically Bethlehem is to Jerusalem like Brooklyn is to Manhattan, except there's not even a river. But there are so many barriers to travel. So it's a 10-minute car trip if you can go on one of those Israeli-only roads. But if you are a Palestinian and you have to travel on the Palestinian roads, you have to go through checkpoints and around this and around the wall and through this place where you can get. It's an hour and a half to get to the neighboring, you know, they're practically contiguous. And then the third pillar were these pass laws. And so again, Palestinians living in the occupied territories, they don't have Israeli citizenship, they don't have Israeli ID, so they can't travel inside Israeli controlled areas. They can't travel freely because they haven't got the proper ID. Now, there are some people who live in East Jerusalem, which East Jerusalem was occupied in 67, was taken over by the Israelis. And so they set up a special system whereby some Palestinians living there have what are called Jerusalem IDs. And this gives them certain privileges and rights that they can travel around certain areas of Jerusalem, that they have certain municipal services, and so on. But what Israel has been doing in trying to annex more and more of Jerusalem and Judahize it is what they do. They want to change the demographic balance so that it becomes more Jewish and less Palestinian. So there are so many barriers, even just within East Jerusalem. If you look at the path of the wall, it's like a snake with little branches. So people living in certain areas of Jerusalem find that they can no longer get to their grocery store or their dentist or their job. So then they start going to a grocery store, dentist, or job that is more facing toward the east, because they can get to that. And then the Israeli authorities say, well, see, life in this area is not really centered on Jerusalem anymore, so you're not going to have a Jerusalem ID anymore. And they take it away. So I think those three pillars are just very clear examples of how Israel has replicated the system that apartheid was in South Africa.
We've been hearing a lot about the violence in the West Bank since October 7th, even though there was a huge amount of violence in the West Bank long before October 7th, really ever since this new administration came in. But not hearing as much about East Jerusalem, although I had heard that Al-Aqsa Mosque had been occupied. Can you bring us up to date on any of that, or have you heard?
Well, yeah, I mean, the Israeli government has been making provocations around Al-Aqsa Mosque for quite a while now. They have been regularly invading with police and troops and interfering with people worshiping. And Al-Aqsa is, I believe, it's the third holiest site in Islam. And so Palestinian Muslims are very sensitive about Israelis and them invading the mosque. And it's been a point of contention because it's built on the Temple Mount, where historically there was a Jewish temple that was destroyed a long, long time ago. So certain Israeli religious zealots would like to get rid of Al-Aqsa and rebuild a Jewish temple there. And they do everything they can to try and disrupt what happens there. I'm not sure about the current exact status, but during the summer and fall, there were several times when Israeli soldiers made incursions into the mosque, arrested worshipers, beat worshipers. I believe they might even have tear gassed
Yeah, I've read
Israeli.
that. Yeah.
So, I mean, can you imagine in a place of worship, soldiers coming in with guns and tear gas and invading one of the most holy places of worship? It's so, of course, the Palestinian population was quite outraged, and then there were retaliatory attacks of Palestinians on Israeli citizens that were provoked by this.
How long has this apartheid system been going on? So there's a couple
Well,
of questions there.
I mean, it started basically in 1948. In 1948, a huge segment of the Palestinian population was displaced by massacres in their villages, and then whoever was left fled, and other people who fled because they heard about the massacres. And when Palestinians left in 48, they took their house keys with them because they thought they would come back in a few days or a few weeks when things cooled off. And a house key is a powerful symbol in Palestine of the right of return. So people fled. Hundreds of thousands of Palestinians were basically pushed out of where they lived and became refugees either on the West Bank or in Gaza. So already you have the displacement and the land grab. Then within what were the Israeli borders at that time, Palestinians and Israelis did not have equal rights. Palestinians within that lived under a kind of martial law, and Jewish citizens had different rights. And there's still people have different rights in terms of immigration, in terms of if you marry somebody, whether they can become a citizen. So if a Palestinian marries their Palestinian partner from one of the occupied territories, they're not automatically going to become a citizen. But if a Jewish person from Israel would marry a Jewish person from Brooklyn, they would easily be able to transition to Israeli citizenship. So it started right there with unequal rights. And then in 67, when Israel invaded the West Bank and Gaza, they put those areas under military control and basically grabbed all of that land. And ever since, they've been building settlements, particularly in the West Bank. They also built settlements in Gaza. They made a big deal out of the fact that they withdrew from Gaza, and so they're not occupying Gaza anymore, they say. So those settlements were abandoned within Gaza, but then they put Gaza under this tight siege since 2007, where there's no one allowed in or out without Israeli permission. So they're still basically controlling movement in the territory. They just until October, they were not physically in there patrolling it.
Well, you mentioned something important right there, because my friend from college said, "Well, why don't the Palestinians in Gaza just leave? Why don't they move away?" And you said, "Nobody in or out."
That's right. People in Gaza, their travel in and out is controlled by the Israeli government. And there are cases of students who would get scholarships to go study in Europe or the United States who would be unable to take advantage of these opportunities because they could not get out. People could not get out for healthcare. So the Israelis would sort of, in a very parsimonious way, let some people in and out for various, healthcare reasons or so on. But basically, the citizens of Gaza cannot travel freely, and people cannot get in there. I myself have tried to get in there several times and have been unable to get in there. There have been boats trying to go there, and if you approach Gaza from the sea, Israel will come out in international waters. Israeli military boats will come out and basically, in an act of piracy, take your boat. And they've been doing that for years. So travel in and out of Gaza is not free. Now, right now, the Israelis, they've been pushing the population further and further to the south. It's documented that several government officials have talked about what they really want to do right now is push the Gazan population all the way out into the Sinai and basically take back over that territory. And people in Gaza do not want to leave right now, even though the situation is so desperate and dangerous, because they know if they leave, they will never come back. They learned that in 1948, and they're not doing that again.
And that's Egypt control that, so
Yeah, no,
they don't want
Egypt
it.
is not for, yeah, I mean, they certainly do not want a population of 1 million or two Palestinian refugees within their territory. And to their credit, they also are not going to play along with this game of ethnic cleansing.
So the apartheid in South Africa stopped.
It did stop, and here's how. It was a combination of nonviolent population protests within the population of South Africa, violent protests as well. There was certainly armed uprisings as well, and some acts of terrorism. In the end, what really did was a worldwide campaign to isolate South Africa economically, politically, diplomatically, culturally. When they tried to send their rugby team on tour, they were protested all over the globe. They became, as Nelson Mandela called it, the skunk of the world. And this was very important because within South Africa, the military repressive apparatus was very, very strong. And so, even though there was massive opposition, and in the case of South Africa, the population imbalance, the white population was much, much smaller than the black population. But even with that, their military repressive apparatus was very, very strong. And it still took this whole worldwide campaign to finally push the country to change its laws. And I think it's worth noting that toward the end, even the US toward the end was respecting the arms embargo against South Africa. But the one country that never respected any embargo and was selling South Africa the arms and the technology that they needed in the end was Israel.
Well, what is your perspective on how this is going to end in Gaza? And is there any chance of it going back to the way it was on October 6th?
I believe that Israel would really like to ethnically cleanse the entire Gaza Strip, and that they would like to push out as much of the Palestinian population as they can and then regain control of that territory and eventually merge it into the rest of Israel and, bring in a Jewish Israeli population and settlements and so on. I believe that that is actually their goal. I think the only thing that will stop them is the rest of the world. I think that just like in South Africa, there are some wonderful people inside Israel who have been doing amazing work against the apartheid system and in solidarity with the Palestinian population. There are some of my best friends are some of these amazing Israeli Jewish activists, but that group is too small. The change is never going to come from within Israel. It has to come from the rest of the world, just as it did in South Africa. I think the only thing that's going to stop Israel from this is if the rest of the world and the United Nations and even our very own United States says, no, you cannot do this. No, we're not going to sell you any more weapons to do this. No. It has to come from the rest of the world because the will inside Israel is to take over.
How much does the U.S. actually facilitate this apartheid?
Without the US, there would be no Israeli apartheid state. The US from the beginning has given support to Israel, and everybody knows, I think, pretty much, we send them about $3 billion a year. That's just the baseline aid that we just send them. And at this point, that monetary aid is not as important as the diplomatic and political cover that the US provides for Israel in the world. We've seen over the past few weeks how many times has the US vetoed or stalled or blocked from coming to a vote resolutions within the Security Council demanding a ceasefire. The US has given Israel the cover that allows it to do this. US has been vetoing resolutions in the Security Council about Israeli settlements, about refugee rights of return. The US has been blocking to the extent of it possible everything that the UN has ever tried to say about Israel. I think the most it ever happened was under Obama once. There was a resolution condemning the growth of settlements, and the US abstained. That was the best we could do, was not block it, not veto it. The US has been like this big wing covering over a little brother Israel and keeping it protected from the criticism of the rest of the world. And to some extent, Europe has also, Europe falls prey to the Israeli to cry anti-Semitism. Any criticism, any attempt to say you have to provide equal rights, any attempts to say you cannot have a country, a Jewish state in which people who are not Jewish don't have the same rights. That's not a democracy. Anybody that says that gets tarred with the brush of being anti-Semitic. And for myself, I'm Jewish, so they can't do that. So I get called a self-hating Jew. So Europe, to some extent, follows along with this, but I think Europe cannot at this point cannot stomach what's going on, and
Do you
so
see a little
that's
bit of movement there in Europe?
a little bit, a little bit. There are a couple of countries that have kicked out Israeli diplomats and broken ties. On the other hand, in Germany, for example, the reaction has been they are cracking down on protests in solidarity with Palestinians, and they are pushing even stronger laws saying you have to support Israel to be a citizen of one German state. Tried to pass a law, I'm not sure if they passed it, that a requirement of citizenship in that German state is that you support Israel's right to exist. So Germany is moved backwards on this.
Talk about anti-Semitism in the United States that has nothing to do with Israel, that's been around for a long
Yeah.
time.
I think that the way Israel uses anti-Semitism as a cudgel to beat its critics is actually detrimental to the real struggle against real anti-Semitism.
Right.
I think that it confuses the issue. Now, if you look at for example, a lot of the evangelical church, they are no friends of the Jews. They are as they a lot of them are just blatantly outright anti-Semitic. They are huge supporters of the state of Israel because they have some, belief that when the Jews have possession of the land of Israel again, then there's a big war and then there's Armageddon and then they all get raptured. I'm not sure exactly how it goes, but
The
something like
Jews who
that.
don't convert will go straight to hell.
Yeah, that would be me. So supporting Israel is not a litmus test for whether you're anti-Semitic or not, because plenty of really virulent anti-Semites are huge, strong supporters of the state of Israel. The real, very real anti-Semitism that is around in this country is coming from not from the Palestinian Solidarity Movement, but from white nationalist movement, and again from the right, really right Christian.
Well, yeah, and my parents were first generation Russian Jews who left around the beginning of the 20th century when pogroms and all that were going increasing. But we lived in Maine, and my parents were from Boston, but my parents had never really observed or practiced any Jewish tradition. Other than the borscht, but we didn't know anything about it, and I heard horrible things about Jews all the time, the whole time growing up, from adults, kids, everybody else. But
Yeah, I grew up in
I
central
think the U.S. has
Pennsylvania
been, oh
where Jew mother was an insult. You
yeah,
Jewed somebody down if you were trying to
right.
bargain.
I've still heard that. Yeah, Jew them down. I met a neighbor who was a friend of me and my brothers, and we were talking about Second World War. This is in the early 60s, and he said, well, my dad said, he says, well, my dad said Hitler was bad, but at least he tried to get rid of the garbage people. I mean, that kind of sounds fun.
No, I mean, there is real anti-Semitism, and I think that it's very dangerous the way Israel has muddied up the waters of trying to understand anti-Semitism. And to me, I have a few responses to some of the people who say, well, how will Jews ever be safe if they're not? So one response that I have is, you're never going to defeat anti-Semitism unless you fight it where it is. So you have to fight it where it is, or you're never gonna get rid of it.
I would love to see something on the members of Congress, Senate, and House. How many of them belong to country clubs, et cetera, that exclude Jews? Because I know in Nashville, the big country clubs that people like Bill Frist belong to, Jews need not apply. But they're going to be the first ones to accuse somebody of anti-Semitism if they're against whatever Israel's doing.
So what you might be saying, Ellen, is these folks that are so pro-Israel and pro-Israel funding from the United States might be really doing backdoor under the cover anti-Semitism.
Yes, and some of it is not under the cover. The religious right is not under the cover about anti-Semitism. Jews are, God doesn't hear our prayers. It's not under the covers at all. And Israel has no problem with these people. They invite them over all the time. The other
Absolutely.
thing that I would say about that is that, first of all, Palestinians are also Semites, and they're more in common with Jews than not. And that the way that you struggle against anti-Semitism is by making principled alliances and solidarity with other anti-racist struggles, and placing anti-Semitism in the context of other racist anti-racist struggles, as opposed to this singularity about the Jews and everybody hates the Jews and we are the most oppressed and it's always all about the Jews. I think that the way you struggle against racism is by making alliances with other oppressed people, not by going and stealing their land and then crying anti-Semitism if somebody cries foul.
So we'll leave Ellen Davidson there, and you can get the full show with Ellen by just going to SoundCloud and searching Veterans for Peace and scrolling. She was on December 28th, 23. Now, on to Dr. Walter Hickson. Today, we have Dr. Walter Hickson, historian commentator whose work has focused on the intersection of American culture and foreign relations. A prolific writer, Hickson has produced a series of works critically examining the history of U.S. foreign relations. His most recent book is Imperialism and War: The History Americans Need to Own. For the past decade, Hickson has focused much of his attention on the Middle East, and especially the issue of Israel-Palestine. In 2021, he published a comprehensive history of the crucial role of the Israel lobby in the Palestinian conflict. The book is entitled Architects of Repression: How Israel and Its Lobby Put Racism, Violence, and Injustice at the Center of U.S. Middle East Policy. Architects of Repression was the follow-up to a previous study entitled Israel's Armor: The Israel Lobby and the First Generation of Palestine Conflict. These richly researched studies have established Hickson as a leading expert on the Israel lobby, spearheaded by AIPAC, which is by far the largest, most well-funded, and influential lobby acting on behalf of a foreign country in American history. Okay, to say he is prolific would be an understatement. And while there are many topics we could discuss, we want to focus on AIPAC and its dangerous influence on U.S. politics, foreign policy, freedom of speech, education, whether it's on the campus or in high school, and more. So, Dr. Hickson, have I gone too far as that assessment on how dangerous AIPAC is?
No, I don't think so. It's certainly a deleterious force in our society. There's no question. For all the reasons you cite, not just bolstering Israeli repression, but also, as you pointed out, undermining freedom of speech and traditional American values.
Where did AIPAC start?
Well, the first book you mentioned, Israel's Armor, is more of a formal academic study for general readers. I recommend Architects of Repression, where I go over everything, but in more depth than Israel's Armor, I looked at the foundations of the lobby, and it goes back to the end of World War II, the aftermath of the Nazi genocide, and the formation of Israel as a state and its recognition by the UN. But before that happened, American Jews, and there were more Jews living in the United States than anywhere else in the world, and really New York was the center of the international Zionist movement. There was a great concern, understandably, for Jewish refugees from the Nazis. And once Israel was being created, American Jews got together and lobbied for funding for relocation of Jewish refugees. And that was the beginning of the lobby. And their organizational efforts were so successful that they realized that they could command great influence in Congress and get funding for the Zionist movement. And they've been getting it ever since.
Well, why were they so successful?
They were well organized. They were centered in the Northeast, where most power was centered in the United States, particularly at that time, before the Sun Belt and all of that. There was a level of guilt in the United States over relative inactivity over the Nazi genocide. And Jews were clearly victims, and so a lot of people could rally behind helping Jewish refugees. But they were just smart and well organized and started letter writing campaigns, lobbying the local representatives. It graduated to rewarding those who supported what the lobby wanted and punishing those who did not, and was very well organized locally. Local Jewish federations connected with national organizations, such as the Congress of Presidents of Major Jewish Organizations. There were close ties with the Israeli state after it emerged. So the lobby was, you might say, vertically integrated from the bottom up in the United States and overseas. And it's just a very well organized lobby that eventually became AIPAC. There were several predecessor organizations, but by around 1960, AIPAC became the central organization, which it remains today. But there are literally hundreds of Jewish lobbying organizations and Zionist lobbying organizations, because they're not all Jewish. They're, of course, are Christian Zionists. So there are really too many to even know, hundreds of these organizations. But no question, AIPAC is the centerpiece.
Of course, now with the favorable response from the ICJ, I'm sure AIPAC is working overtime to undermine that in any way they can. Can you give us any idea what to expect?
Well, I'm better versed in the history than I mean, of course, I follow what's going on now, but I don't have any
Yeah.
particular knowledge that
Right.
you might not have. But yes, I mean, I know without knowing, if you will.
Right.
They're working overtime, absolutely, on that, and they are relentless. You could look up online AIPAC headquarters and see the tall building in Washington, D.C. There's over 300 employees. I always am amazed by people who deny the influence of the lobby, and there's a lot of that. Ironically, the lobby promotes denying of the existence of the lobby. But, there's over 300 propagandists always at work in the United States, particularly in the Congress, which I use it. It's a very strong term, but I'm pretty comfortable using it. They own the U.S. Congress. The U.S. Congress does what Israel and the lobby want them to do. I mean, witness today, we've got the slaughter of 25,000 people going on, children being killed every day. And, it doesn't stop. It's not brought to a halt. And the United States, as is often the case, is standing relatively alone in world affairs in opposing a ceasefire. So the lobby's always at work. It's a real thing. This is not some conspiracy theory. They're very good at what they do. They're very experienced and very good at it, as you would expect a powerful lobby to be. You wouldn't expect Big Pharma to be bad at its job. You wouldn't expect the old elderly person's lobby to be bad at its job. And they're not. They're very good at it. They're very good at lobbying. And it's by far the most powerful lobby representing the interests of a foreign country in American history, but it's one of the most powerful lobbies, period, in American life.
But even Big Pharma and military industrial complex, all these amazing influencers, they don't attack people the way AIPAC seems bent on doing in terms of smearing and accusations. And I expect they'll be revving that up too.
Now that's a really good point. I'm glad you mentioned that. One of the major arguments I have in Architects of Repression is that what's unique about Israel? So historically speaking, Israel, like the United States, like Australia, like many other countries, is a, I like to describe it as a congenitally aggressive, that is aggressive from birth, settler society. It's a product of settler colonialism. So is the United States. And this is just a phenomenon where you come in, you root out the indigenous population, and you take the land for yourself, and you depict yourself as the as your homeland and displace the original inhabitants. So in that sense, Israel's not unlike the United States, and that helps explain why they're so closely associated. But here's the big difference, and getting to your question, or the point you raised. It was one thing for Israel or for the United States and Australia in the 19th century to be rooting out indigenous people and conducting ethnic cleansing and killing quote-unquote savages, etc. It's quite another thing after World War II when, ironically, because of the Nazi genocide in large part, along with general Nazi militarism and Japanese militarism, the UN was created and promulgated the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. So in other words, Israel comes to birth and conducts cleansing operations at the very moment that the international community is establishing a structure in the UN to try to keep this from happening again. So the point here is that this makes propaganda and disinformation and attack on critics all the more important, because it's not legitimate to be a repressive ethnic cleansing state. And in order to exist in that climate, you have to deny that you are an illegitimate, relentlessly oppressive ethnic cleansing state, apartheid state. Israel is clearly an apartheid state now. You can't be a democracy and privilege one group of people over another. That's apartheid. And so that's what they are. So anyway, the point I'm trying to make is the lobby is super important, and attacks on critics are super important, having to do with Israel coming of age late as a repressive settler state, as opposed to the history of the United States and Australia, for example.
Can you give us a couple of examples specifically of candidates, people in Congress or whatever, that AIPAC has actually come out against and maybe derailed their candidacy? I mean, I would think off the top of my head, Nina Turner from Ohio a couple of years ago, there was a lot of AIPAC money along with problems with the DNC that derailed her when she was up double digits for a long time.
Yeah, also gerrymandering here in Ohio is pretty bad, helped derail her. Sure, I mean, they routinely go up against any critical voices in Congress. They're very blatant about it. You either support us or we'll find somebody who does and try to replace you. And they use money to do that. They don't always win. So Ilhan Omar, they'd love to get rid of her from Minnesota, but her local people keep rallying behind her. Betty McConnell, also of Minnesota, who's committed the sin of promoting a bill that would end incarceration of children in Israel. They don't want to have that.
And I found this clip from Counterpoints, part of Breaking Points. This is Ryan Grimm and Emily Kaczynski.
The context, of course, is that, you know, AIPAC is putting together an unprecedented level of spending to try to wipe out the squad in Congress. Meanwhile, they're facing a cascading number of their own scandals. We'll talk about Cori Bush, Jamal Bowman, and Ilhan Omar in this segment. Let's start with Cori Bush. It was reported yesterday that she's under DOJ investigation for over her campaign spending on security.
Yeah, she does have a primary challenge, right, that's being funded by AIPAC.
Wesley Bell was running for Senate, jumped out of the Senate race and into the House race after October 7th, when it appeared that, you know, Bush could be vulnerable to a well-financed challenger. He announced he had raised $600,000. AIPAC has already been spending. AIPAC was spending against her before she had an opponent mm-hmm. through its super PAC. Mm-hmm. So that, yes, they're absolutely coming for her. So this will wind up, I think, in all of the super PAC ads mm-hmm. that, because Marie Newman, who AIPAC took out in 2022, because she represented a huge kind of Palestinian population in Illinois, had a congressional ethics review underway, and they made that like the focus of their, you know, massive spending against her. So if you have 30 seconds and, you know, if to do an ad and you got $1 million to spread it, you can make someone look really, really bad. Mm-hmm. We'll see whether or not people kind of believe it. So Bowman is also facing an AIPAC-backed challenger, George Latimer, Westchester County executive.
So they routinely target all critics and promote financially and otherwise their supporters, and they don't always win, but they win a lot. And there are, other than those few progressive critics and Bernie Sanders pretty much alone in the Senate, it's almost not an exaggeration to say no one criticizes Israel. It's not legitimate in this culture and society to criticize Israel traditionally, but it's changing. And the more they, you know, do this blatant slaughter of people, the more it's changing. And also very important, our larger numbers of American Jews are questioning their unquestioned previously support for Israel. For generations, it was sort of the duty of an American Jew to be pro-Israel. And that was through Jewish education, institutions, et cetera, emphasized. But American Jews are generally more liberal and progressive people, and they're more and more, larger numbers are alert to the fact that the Israel they've supported is not the Israel that really exists. So things are changing, but you know, in Congress, I tell the story of Mitch McConnell. He narrowly won election in Kentucky in 1984 against the incumbent T. Huddleston. And McConnell, of course, who's a brilliant political operator, went to AIPAC, who supported the incumbent Huddleston because he was fairly favorable to them. And he said, "Hey, fellas, what can I do to get your support next time?" And they said, "That's easy, Mitch. Just do what we tell you to do. Support Israel uncritically and you'll be fine." He has. And ever since, now McConnell has received more financial assistance from AIPAC than any other politician in American history. Even more troubling to me, it's probably not fair to single him out, but I always discuss the case of Cory Booker, a senator from New Jersey who's African-American and eloquent in his pleas for justice. On Martin Luther King Day, he routinely gives a beautiful speech about King's influence and justice and equality. And then he toes the line 100% on Israeli repression of Palestine. So it just shows you how powerful the lobby is. And scholars and journalists refer to the Palestine exception. You know, it's support for human rights and victims of oppression, except for Palestine. And it doesn't happen there.
Has their tentacles reached down into states and local governments?
Oh, absolutely. It's connected with local Jewish federations. One of the reasons I got to really know about the lobby was I wrote an article in our local newspaper, the Akron Beacon Journal. I wrote an op-ed piece critical of Israeli policies, and replies poured in from the local Jewish federations and leaders, and it was clear that it was an orchestrated attack. That's what they do. They rally against any critics, for any supporters. It begins at the local level. They're tied in with state and national organizations, and they're linked up with the Israeli state as well. I mean, AIPAC has an office in Jerusalem. It's no secret that they work closely together.
Do you think they're behind some of the legislation that some states have said can't be behind the BDS program?
It's important that you mentioned BDS. So there's a couple of points where the lobby really accelerated its activism. So I'll put it in historical context and then talk about more of the present. In the Reagan administration, Reagan was very pro-Israel, but the United States was also interested in cultivating Saudi Arabia and sold defensive weapons system to Saudi Arabia in the early 1980s. This was opposed sharply by the lobby, but Reagan was a popular president. It narrowly passed, and the lobby decided to redouble its efforts. So more money was pumped in, and most of the money pumped in is from a handful of super rich Orthodox Jews. Very conservative Orthodox Jews. Most Jews are not Orthodox or very conservative, but the handful that are super rich, and Reagan was at the same time initiating massive tax cuts, which enabled these wealthy donors to give even more money. Mm-hmm. So they bolstered their efforts in the 1980s. So the point I'm making is when the lobby feels threatened, it redoubles its efforts and pumps more money into its propaganda and disinformation. All right, speed ahead to the 2000s, and we've got the BDS that you mentioned, the boycott, divestment, and sanctions. So this, on the South African model, as you know, was a campaign to try to punish Israel economically by boycotting and sanctioning it, boycotting its products, isolating it internationally economically. And this was a serious threat to Israel and the lobby, and they've responded with an extremely active and well-funded attack program that you alluded to. And it's come to the point where criticism of Israel is routinely equated with anti-Semitism. And that's what's happening at the state level with these primitive legislative initiatives that you mentioned that essentially do that and attack universities and professors as well. You know, one of the most disgusting lobby efforts has been an entity called Canary Mission, which online condemns not just professors, but students. In groups like Students for Justice in Palestine, equates them with being anti-Semites. You're right. What's being done is just a deliberate effort to obscure any line between criticism of Israel and outright anti-Semitism. I like to say, sadly, that the lobby's not content to take rights away from Palestinians. They want to take rights away from Americans as well.
Do they have any direct connection to any defamation league? It seems like they're at least working from a similar playbook a lot of the time.
Oh, sure. Anti-Defamation League is part of the lobby. When I reference the lobby, I'm using a small L, encompassing a vast number of groups. It's not just AIPAC. AIPAC, because of the annual conferences it used to hold. Okay. And by the way, it's interesting that they aren't holding these any longer. They suspended them for COVID, but haven't restarted them. I think they have come to the conclusion that they're a little too blatant. All these Israeli flags, all these members of Congress prostrating themselves before the Israeli flag and coming and giving these speeches about how great Israel is and how criticism of it is anti-Semitic, etc. It's a little too blatant, I think they've decided, and they're opting for a little subtlety. But yeah, the ADF is a big part of the lobby. So there's, as I mentioned, hundreds of groups that you can lump into the lobby and work together. They don't always agree on everything. But in general, they do and are on the same page and are extremely well-organized and determined lobby.
Is Israel concerned at all that the optics of the fact that so often the targets of their attacks are people of color?
Apparently not. And, you know, there's also, they're able to build on a little bit of a historic alliance between Jews and African Americans as discriminated groups that have been historically discriminated against in American society. And I mentioned Booker as a good example, you know, of how that holds up to some extent. But, you know, it's an apartheid state, and you would think that would arouse all sorts of charges of racism, and it does in other countries and in the UN, but not in the United States. If your listeners aren't aware, they should look into the history of American vetoes of UN Security Council resolutions on Israel. And it's amazing. The votes are, you know, like 104-2 with the United States and Israel and maybe throw in the Marshall Islands opposing these efforts and the U.S. vetoing censures and resolutions. So most of the world does get this connection that you mentioned between racism and Israeli actions. But in the United States, not so much. The U.S. is also the heartland of Christian Zionism. That's a factor as well. And, you know, I wouldn't overrate it, particularly on the funding. They don't fund it as much as these Orthodox Jews individuals do, you know, like Sheldon Adelson, the former casino magnate who died, but his wife still pumps bazillions into the lobby. But the on the ground support by Christian Zionists is important as well.
But they couldn't do all of this without media complicity, right?
Oh, that's a major problem. Yes, I agree totally. You know, it's not that the media is formally part of the lobby and conniving with them. It doesn't particularly work that way. But certainly the New York Times has played a major role. I mentioned New York as the traditional heartland of Zionism. New York Times coverage has been warped and unfavorable from the get-go. I mean, it's a great newspaper that has a lot of outstanding reporting. But again, the Palestine exception has appeared throughout the history of this conflict and of the New York Times. For example, when human rights organizations, including the Israeli Human Rights Organization, said that it was appropriate to call Israel an apartheid state, the New York Times didn't even cover that. You know, there's a lot of very dubious reporting on these Hamas rapes, alleged rapes. There's very little formal evidence of this. And I'm not here to promote Hamas or particularly defend Hamas, although it should be pointed out that Israel helped create Hamas. And if it wasn't for Israeli repression, there would be no Hamas. But when you look at all the information, there's very little direct evidence. You would think there would be photographic and video evidence. You know, we watch all these crime shows on television. There's plenty of ways to demonstrate that things happen conclusively. And they haven't done that. And I'm also dubious. We'll see. I'm not saying it's wrong or denying it necessarily. But this charge of the UN workers aiding Hamas, it may very well be so. We should treat every report as with a very critical eye, because the propaganda does get into the media. And you're certainly correct that the U.S. media has traditionally been very pro-Israel and reluctant to criticize or report effectively on Israeli apartheid and repression. I wouldn't go too far with it. There is a lot of critical reporting, particularly outside the mainstream. There's a lot of sources of knowledge about Israel's cleansing and repression and apartheid. But in general, I agree with your statement that the media has been largely complicit in this issue.
I remember seeing a recent documentary on Israel's management of media and how they control the narrative.
It's a great documentary. This slaughter in Gaza today is unique because it's so massive and it's a formal war, but it's not the first time that Israel has indiscriminately bombed and slaughtered people in Gaza. Mm-hmm. There were major wars. They're not really wars, they're slaughters. I mean, this is one of the most elite militarized states in the world history against a densely populated, largely defenseless country with rudimentary weapons that it does has fired, of course, these rockets, which do relatively little damage to Israel, whereas Israel just pummels Gaza. Mm-hmm. And so the film focuses on that. You know, hopefully before we're done.
But even a lot of people have pointed out that, you know, just the terminology that's used to describe what happened to Israel versus what's happening to Gaza. Adjectives like horrific,
yeah, they
only show, you know, have been thousands of citations for what happened
exactly.
To Israel, but none of it for the 25,000 dead.
You make a good point. They establish talking points,
right,
and key phrases, and you can tell it's orchestrated because they're repeated up and down the line, you know, from local level to international level. And it's clearly an orchestrated propaganda effort that doesn't necessarily come off that way. And, you know, that film really shows how they do that.
And I've just noticed, you know, the networks or cable, when they do interview an Israeli spokesperson, it's like they have a script.
Let me interrupt you for 1 second, because I think, Jim, are you looking for it?
I'm trying, yeah.
The narrator of that was Roger Waters of Pink Floyd. So okay. That might help you find the name of it. I'm sorry, go ahead. I interrupted.
When they're questioned like about the desecration of cemeteries or the attacking of hospitals, and the script that the Israelis use basically say human shields or
right.
You know, these, you know, and that there's never any follow-up question. There's never any challenge to that from the
No, that's right. It's very chilling. I've seen a couple of interviews with, you know, Israeli military officials in the mainstream media, and they are asking them, they say, what about the slaughter of civilians and innocents? And they say, well, that's all Hamas's fault. They put their, you know, their operations in, and it's really chilling because they're essentially justifying mass slaughter and certainly exaggerating the extent to which, of course, Hamas is going to try to insulate itself as much as possible, but it's vastly overstated.
Is it the occupation of the American mind?
Yes, it is. That's Bingo. The film. So I'm glad you mentioned it. So I urge everyone, if you can, watch that documentary, The Occupation of the American Mind. It may be 6, 8 years old now, but exactly what it shows really illustrates how the lobby operates and gets these talking points and select phrases out there. Thank you for looking that up.
So we will leave our combo show right there. You've just heard Dr. Walter Hickson on the dangers of AIPAC, and before that, Ellen Davidson on apartheid. And to hear both of those shows in their entirety, just go to soundcloud.com and search Veterans for Peace. Ellen's show was on December 28th of 2023, and Dr. Hickson was on February 8th of 2024. So to end this show, I want to share a song from friend of the show, Joseph DiFilippo and the R.J. Phillips Band. It is called One More Bridge to Cross. One More Bridge to Cross. And it remembers Bloody Sunday, March 7th, 1965. So we just had its 59th anniversary. And if you want to share this wonderful song, you can also find it on SoundCloud. Just search One More Bridge to Cross. And with that, here it is.
Could the Edmund Pettus hold our weight? Its presence a reminder of centuries of hate. We joined hands as the Reverend said a prayer. Father, won't you walk with us as we face the devil's glare? One more bridge to cross, one more cross to bear. Selma to Montgomery, on the road to Calvary. One more bridge to cross, one more cross to bear. A cry for freedom filled the air. A state trooper murdered Jimmy Lee, left his wife and children in poverty. Justice now in Alabama. You can't trust the sheriff, and he's also in the Klan. One more bridge to cross, one more cross to bear.
Cross, one more cross to bear, a cry for freedom.
freedom fills the air.